With the unofficial start of summer in Texas, a reevaluation of what we've endured and what's ahead. The state of the fight against COVID-19, that's today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Texas-based vaccine expert Dr. Peter Hotez gets us up to speed on the impact of the relaxation of stay-at-home guidelines in Texas. Also, why many daycares now authorized to reopen may not make it despite economic recovery efforts. An update on the coronavirus story unfolding just south of the border, and a rediscovered history of women and the high court. All those stories and a whole lot more coming up on the Texas Standard, and we'll get started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this Memorial Day in the United States. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. This is a day that we used to call Decoration Day, and though we've been observing it since shortly after the end of the Civil War, some don't realize it's a relatively new innovation in the federal calendar, becoming an official holiday in 1971. Today we reflect on and offer our thanks to those who fought and served in the military and made the ultimate sacrifice for their country. Though no one alive can recall a Memorial Day quite like this one, can they? As we go to air, the Texas General Land Office is hosting a Memorial Day service online, a technical and medical concession to the ongoing war against COVID-19. Retired Navy four-star Admiral William McCraven is set to speak. For many Texans, Memorial Day marks not just a day of reflection, but something like the unofficial start of summer, too. A dividing line on the calendar, if you will. And over the weekend, we saw many people across the nation returning to the beaches and swimming pools to beat the heat without much apparent regard for social distancing and face masks. Though a welcome sight to some, it's hard to imagine those images didn't catch the eye of Dr. Peter Hotez. Since the start of this pandemic, the founding dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine and professor of pediatrics and molecular virology and microbiology at the Baylor College of Medicine has become a go-to around the world for insight on the race for a vaccine and efforts to combat the coronavirus. He joins us now to talk about the state of the state in this fight as Texas moves toward the next phase in reopening businesses on May 31st. Dr. Hotez, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
I want to start with a story making headlines in recent days. Last week, Texas's Department of State Health Services revealed that its daily COVID-19 test count included viral tests, which test whether a person currently has the virus, as well as an antibody test, which tells whether someone did have the virus. Now, I'm curious, this conflation has been happening across the country, too. Apparently, the CDC made the same mistake. How much does this compromise what we know and don't know about where we stand in the fight against COVID-19?
Well, you know, I have sort of a somewhat unique point of view on this, which is that our testing has been so mangled nationally and that we have such modest levels of testing across the country, even though the number, the president and the White House always talks about the total numbers of tests. That's true. It's pretty high. But when you look at the size of our country, we're still underachieving, and we're certainly underachieving and have been underachieving in Texas. So rather than beat a dead horse and, complain we're not testing enough, one of the things that I think we can really step up and do a much better job with is what's called syndromic surveillance, where you do some sentinel testing to get a better sense of who's popping up with fever, who's popping up with respiratory symptoms. And there's a number of different systems that are out there. And I think that might give us a better sense. And there's urgency because depending on whose models you look at, now that we're relaxing social distancing ahead of the time when we were supposed to do it, we're seeing some projections of pretty steep increases in the number of cases in places like Harris County, Dallas County. So I'm really worried as we head into the summer.
Well, now, when you consider all the data out there, the daily cases, the deaths, the hospitalizations, the positivity rate, what are the metrics that matter most to you? What are you paying most attention to right now?
What I pay attention to are a couple of things. One, ICU admissions and hospitalizations, because you can't hide those. That's something very real and tangible. Not that anyone's trying to deliberately hide anything, but you get the idea that that's something is real and you can hang on to. And those numbers, have overall done pretty well in the state of Texas because we enacted social distancing early on when we saw things going badly in New York. So I look at the hospitalizations and ICU admissions, and then I, you know, try to look at the projections, because the way this works is as follows. As we see a relaxing of social distancing, if the cases go up, if you look at all the models, it's not that the cases go up in a linear fashion. You see, okay, a little more tomorrow, a little more after that, a little more after that. The way it works is things will stay flat, and they'll probably stay flat for another month. And people will get this false sense of complacency and say, hey, this is not so bad, and they're going to start going back into the bars and get life as usual. And then the cases start to rise precipitously. And then it's too late. Then you start seeing ICUs and hospital beds get overwhelmed. So that's why I'm thinking, let's put this syndromic surveillance system in place so we can at least pick that up a little sooner. And because, you know, the, some of the models coming out of Philadelphia, the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and Penn Policy Lab, look absolutely apocalyptic when you see the numbers going up. And I hope that doesn't happen, but it's not impossible.
When you assess the trends that we're seeing as the state continues its phased reopening, what do you make of it? I mean, do you think that the governor has handled this well? He says he's being consulted. He's getting consultations from health experts from across the state. What do you make of it?
Well, you know, the governor's in a tight spot, and I actually, you know, have some empathy for the governor. You know, it's tough. I mean, it's hard. Well, first of all, it's heartbreaking, right, to see, you know, we at Texas has had one of the most strongest economies anywhere in the nation. And I, like a lot of Texans, like to think of Texas as the Republic of Texas, and with an economy the size of Russia or Australia, and to watch that economy suffer is really heartbreaking. So I get it, and I get his urgency to open things up. But then if you're going to do that, put the checks and balances that you need to ensure you can sustain that economy, because if the cases start rising again, everything's going to fold. So that means putting in place all of those things that are somewhat inconvenient, which is the scaling up testing at work, scaling up contact tracing. I think the number of contact tracers that have been hired is something like 2,000, whereas Cuomo in New York has hired 17,000 for a state that's much smaller. I mean, why aren't we using our resources? Texas has the greatest engineers in the world because of our oil and gas industry and NASA and the Texas Medical Center. Let's bring some of those people together to create the world's greatest syndromic surveillance system. We're leaving a lot of stuff on the table.
Well, now let me ask you, because I mentioned those photographs that have been circulating online about people at beaches and in swimming pools. And yet, you know, I go to Home Depot or something, and there are lines as people, you know, are watching the doors and making sure that there aren't that the building isn't overcrowded. There's 6 feet distance between everyone. Everyone's wearing a mask. Do you get the sense that people are collectively letting their guard down, or are we doing this right?
No, I think we will. You know, it's human nature, right? We're going to start letting our guard down. You know, we're hearing all of these phase one, phase two, one quarter full, one half full. I don't see it lasting very long. I think people will keep it up for a week or two, and then it's going to be back to business. And with that, I think that's when you're going to start not right away again, but, you know, by July or August, we could see that steep rise. I mean, the only way we're going to get away with this is if the effects of sunlight and heat really are substantial. And we don't really know that. So that might mitigate somewhat, but how much, I can't really tell you.
Before we sign off, Dr. Hotez, I want to ask about some of the vaccination news that we've been hearing lately. Several vaccine developers announcing last week they'd made progress on potential drugs that could safely inoculate people from COVID-19. Is there any approach that to you in particular looks promising?
You know, the vaccine data that I've seen so far in non-human primates and in the one clinical trial we've seen in people have not been all that impressive. Because, you know, one of the things that we found working on coronavirus vaccines over the last decade and in the data so far is that much of it is about achieving high levels of a certain type of antibody called neutralizing antibody. And so far, the levels that I've been seeing is sort of meh, not terribly impressive. So far, what we're looking at maybe it could be partially protective vaccines at best. But again, it's still early. So there's still opportunities for improvement. There's still opportunities for tweaks. We're hoping to get our vaccine into clinical trials sometime later this year, maybe by September. And so there's still a long road ahead. But this idea that we're going to have a vaccine available for everybody for the fall, I think we have to get out of that notion.
Dr. Hotez, you're an educator as well as an expert in vaccines. I'm just curious, as you step back for a moment, what sort of grade would you give Texas on managing and handling the coronavirus so far?
Well, if you'd asked me that 2 weeks ago, I would have said you get an A rating. And the reason is because we saw bad stuff happening in New York City, and we said we don't want that to happen here. We implemented aggressive social distancing, and we bought ourselves a lot of time. But I'm concerned now what we're seeing over the last couple of weeks, which is relaxing social distancing, and I get that. But two trends are happening that worry me. One is that people think it's all over and it's business as usual, and then we're not putting in place all the things we could be to ensure we can open safely in terms of the public health infrastructure. And it's no fault of the public health leaders. I think the city and county health directors are doing everything they can. They're just not being given all the tools and resources they need to get the job done.
Dr. Peter Hotez is professor of pediatrics and dean for the National School of Tropical Medicine, Baylor College of Medicine. Dr. Hotez, good to talk with you again, sir. Thank you so much for your time.
Great. Thanks so much.
So let's check in with our social media editor, Wells Dunbar, find out how things are breaking across social media in the Lone Star State. Hello there, Wells.
Hello, David. We're hearing from our friends and listeners on this Memorial Day. Many folks remarking on scenes captured on social media over the weekend, crowded scenes at bars, pools, beaches, and rivers of people partying without any regard for social distancing. Austin's own Mayor Steve Adler retweeting scenes from the capital city, naming and shaming two establishments with shoulder-to-shoulder crowds via Twitter. Erica Albright says her main concern is for the overload in medical care such gatherings could create. On Facebook, Michael Hathaway, citing the number of coronavirus deaths, says he is staying at home because we're about to have a separate Memorial Day. And Dallas Hall writes that as of this morning, there were over 98,000 dead from COVID-19 in the U.S., more than those that died on 9/11, more than the people that died in the Korean War, and more than died in Vietnam. Some sobering numbers we're seeing on social media from our friends and listeners today, David. I'll be back with more later in the program.
How are you marking Memorial Day in Texas? We'd love to hear from you. Tweet us at Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is looking for you, and he'll be back in about 35 minutes or so as the Texas Standard continues.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
I'm Sophia Moore. I'm a soon-to-be graduate of LASA. LASA is the Liberal Arts and Science Academy, and it's a magnet program here in Austin. And I'm going to be attending UT Austin in the fall, majoring in international relations. The Friday before spring break, we just didn't come back to school, and we haven't gone back since. Online learning is nowhere near as fun or engaging as in class. I'm someone who works best with materials when I can talk about it and like engage with my classmates, but you can't really get that in online learning. There are so many things that I'm so upset that I'm missing. We missed out on senior prom, and I'm the the class president, so this was going to be my big event, and that was so sad when that was canceled. I'm in the songwriting class for the first time, and the songwriting class always throws this big concert-style event at the end of the year called Coffee House, and it's always been my favorite tradition at Lhasa, and I was finally going to be able to be a part of it. And we're still doing it online, but it's not the same. Senior prank, I had an entire committee around that, and now all of that work is going to be for naught. But I think that the biggest thing that I'll miss out on is just feeling like there's any closure. At the end of all the other years of high school and of middle school, you've always gotten to walk around the hallways with your friends, just kind of existing, not feeling too tied to any of the classes anymore. And that, for me, is when it just kind of signals that everything's over. And the days when you don't bring backpacks to school, I think I'll miss out on that. I don't know. It doesn't feel like there's any closure. I know the school's ending soon, but it doesn't feel like it. Quarantine has given me more time to get closer to my family. I've appreciated that. And also, this time at home has given me a lot more time to work on my music, so I'm getting a lot better at guitar, and I picked up a bass, and so I'm working on that. The plan right now is to have graduation in August in person. I'm gonna be so disappointed if my introduction to college is through a screen. I am worried if they charge full tuition for online classes. I don't think that will be fair at all. And I might go to community college for a while just to balance out that cost. The class of 2020 has gotten such a unique experience with their senior year, both the seniors that are graduating from college and high school. We're missing out on some traditions, but we're having a completely new experience, and no one will be able to say that they've gotten this same treatment. Fingers crossed, of course. Hopefully the next year's seniors won't have to deal with this. I'm Sophia Moore. I'm a graduating senior from Lhasa, and you're listening to the Texas Standard.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis, including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. When the coronavirus outbreak forced schools to close, teachers as well as students had to quickly shift gears to online learning, and that's meant some creative solutions to bridge the physical distance in the online Texas classroom. But as this unprecedented year wraps up, Houston Public Media's Laura Eisensee reports some Texas students are still falling off the radar.
From Her Home in Aldine, bilingual teacher Rachel Clark starts the week off by making a special video for her fifth graders in the district.
Hi, students. Hola, alumnos. This is Ms. Clark.
All 50 are learning English. As the week goes on, she sends videos with more personalized feedback.
Buenas tardes, Genesis. Te echo menos un montón.
In this one, Clark tells a student she misses her a ton and is proud of all of her reading.
Por leer cuatro libros ya.
Clark spent 20 years in the classroom. Now teaching remotely, these videos are essential.
Seems like the more personalized I can make it, the better. Also, that I absolutely need to get over whatever I look like on camera, because it doesn't really matter. You know, it doesn't matter my grades are showing or any of those other things. Kids need to see me.
Teachers have come up with other ways to stay connected. One in Clark's district set up a special Instagram account for middle schoolers. Sometimes they'll ask classmates to check in on peers.
Educators have done an incredible job in a very short time of totally shifting a system.
That's Duncan Klusman. He's a retired superintendent and teaches educational leadership at the University of Houston.
But the reality is we're still missing a lot of students, too. I've talked to school leaders who, in some cases, have not been able to connect or identify with a third of their students.
That's a third of their students. It's a struggle for schools across Texas. San Antonio ISD lost contact with several thousand elementary students early on, and the Houston Independent School District is still trying to get in touch with over 10,000 children. Rachel Clark says only half of her class is turning in assignments, and that's okay, she says, because she knows many families are stressed out about basic needs.
And it's just, you know, learning isn't a focus, and I'm not judging parents for that.
In the Aldine Independent School District, where Clark teaches, almost 9 out of 10 children are economically disadvantaged. So she's tried to meet families where they're at, and it's worked, except for one little boy. Even before the pandemic, she was having trouble reaching his mom. Clark had planned to visit his home.
There is a part of me sometimes in the back of my head that's like, if I had just done that home visit, maybe I could get that kid too.
At first, Aldine school staff could only reach about a quarter of their nearly 70,000 students.
Completely going distance means you don't see a student.
Shalia Reed is with the district.
So you can't tell a student, hey, tell your mom to call me. Or, you know, can you give me your new phone number?
But week by week, Reed says they've tracked down more kids. They're up to 95%, and it's largely been thanks to educators on the ground.
Teachers, coaches, as well as like extracurricular staff members.
Reed says over months in the classrooms, teachers had built relationships with kids and knew where to look. Rachel Clark, the bilingual teacher in Aldine and a counselor, finally contacted her missing fifth grader after some old-fashioned detective work.
We found an uncle whose child also goes to school here, and then they were able to get us in contact with mom with the updated phone number. So I'm very excited. I know all of my kids are okay.
Now the Aldine School District's checking in on families to see if they need any extra help heading into summer. In Houston, I'm Laura Eisensee.
All right, Texas, how are you thinking about Memorial Day on this Monday? We'd love to hear from you. Look for us on social media. It's Texas Standard. Facebook, Twitter, all the usual suspects. We've got the Texas Roundup just around the corner. Want to stick around for that. Coming up on 29 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard time.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. A virtual Memorial Day ceremony is wrapping up this morning in lieu of gatherings traditionally held at the four Texas State Veterans Cemeteries. The keynote speaker is retired four-star Admiral William McCraven. He began by remembering those who fought in World War II.
That greatest generation was filled with remarkable Texans, men and women who served valiantly, whose courage and commitment was exactly what we would expect from our fellow Texans.
The event is streaming on the Veterans Land Board Facebook page. Houston Mayor Sylvester Turner says the city will need to enforce the state's occupancy guidelines after more than 250 complaints were lodged during Memorial Day weekend. The Texas governor has allowed a variety of establishments to reopen at reduced capacity amid the COVID-19 pandemic. That includes bars, restaurants, and pools. Turner said Sunday he was hoping people and business owners would voluntarily comply with the restrictions, adding most have.
But if it's a situation based on some of the pictures that I've seen, that it is clear that people are crowded in, almost look like to maximum capacity, on top of one another, no social distancing, no masks, then you're forcing us to step in for public health reasons to say no.
The Houston Professional Firefighters Association issued a statement criticizing Turner's call for fire officials to enforce capacity regulations, saying, quote, the mayor should give out masks, not citations, end quote. A small North Texas city is recovering from widespread damage an EF1 tornado caused when it touched down Friday night. Bowie Mayor Galen Burris said Saturday the severe weather downed hundreds of trees.
I think we have about 200 homes through the city of Bowie that have been damaged, some more significant than others.
That audio is courtesy of WFAA. Burris added an estimated 50 businesses downtown took some kind of hit from the tornado, such as damage to windows, roofs, and doors. Governor Greg Abbott sent state resources to the area to assist with recovery efforts. And the state's three-day sales tax holiday for water and energy-efficient products ends tonight. Kevin Lyons with the Texas Comptroller's Office says items with the WaterSense logo can be purchased tax-free.
These include items like shower heads, bathroom sink faucets, toilets, urinals, and landscape irrigation controls. That holiday also applies to lawn and garden products to help conserve water outdoors.
Certain products that have the Energy Star logo are also tax-free. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from BiteAway, a chemical-free treatment alternative to instantly relieve the itch and pain caused by insect bites. Portable, reusable, and no mess. Suitable for children. Learn more at TakeTheBiteAway.com.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. When it comes to child care during this pandemic, much attention has been paid to the parents and caretakers suddenly left figuring out how to entertain little ones that usually or used to go to daycare. But the daycares themselves have also been in a bit of a scramble. Most never shut down completely. They've been open to serve families of essential workers in Texas. But even now that Governor Abbott's allowed them to open back up completely, we're reading that some are on the brink of financial failure. Charles Scudder has been writing about this for the Dallas Morning News. Charlie, thanks for your time. We appreciate you joining us on the Texas Standard.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
First, we should clarify something here. Daycares can be opened back up, but they're not operating the same way that they were pre-pandemic. What all's changed?
That's right. It's similar to a lot of other businesses. It's kind of a slow return to normalcy or whatever that looks like, depending on the field. For daycares, that means new policies in place as far as making sure everything's sanitized. It also means smaller class sizes and a higher teacher-to-student ratio and stuff like that. So it's just a slow return to full capacity, basically.
But, you know, the idea of opening up or broadening the reopening of daycares was to support their financial recovery. How are the daycares doing on that score?
You know, it's tough. Just like, again, with just about every industry out there, it's really tough, especially the daycare workers I talk to said that they have been open to serve the families of essential workers, but that means that that's a lot less kids they've been seeing for the last several months, which of course means less money coming in, which is making things hard to make ends meet. You know, one daycare I talked to normally serves 80 kids, now has just 12. Another normally has 50-something kids, now only has 4. And that makes it really difficult, especially when parents are slow to bring their kids back.
Is that what it is, that parents are afraid to bring their kids back, or what's going on?
I don't know if it's parents being afraid to bring their kids back, but, you know, a lot of folks are still working from home. And if they're working from home, why would they spend the money to take the kids to daycare? I think it's part of it. But it is difficult, and a lot of daycares are saying that they're not getting the interest of families want rushing back to the daycare.
Well, as I understand it, daycares were eligible for the Paycheck Protection Program, but of course they had to compete with everyone else. Wasn't there also a state program that was supposed to help pay for the child care of essential workers? Wouldn't that have had some kind of impact?
That's right, and it did help some. There's other daycares that didn't take state funding to begin with and therefore were ineligible for that program. One of the daycares I talked to up in Carrollton, Texas, already didn't take a lot of state funding, and so they had essential workers leave because they could get free daycare elsewhere. I've also heard that it wasn't a lot of money compared to the cost per child. So depending on the daycare, it may not have been financially worth it to participate in that program.
Well, what about the financial outlook of these daycares? Because there, if not now, there will come a time when these daycares will be essential for a return to normal. What are these facilities saying about their financial outlook? How long can they continue to operate?
It's tough, and it depends on the daycare and the business, just like, again, every other field out there. But they are struggling, and a lot of the places I talk to say that they are on the brink of bankruptcy or having to close their doors because they're just not getting the income that they did before this all started.
Do they have any ideas about how they might be able to get back to normal if parents are unwilling to take their kids to daycare centers?
That's the big question. I'm not sure. I think that the biggest thing I've heard is that these daycare owners want to be able to take these kids back. They want to be able to take care of the kids because, again, it's a mission-driven work for them. They like taking care of the kids. They like working with the kids, and they want to be able to see them again.
I wonder if this is a harbinger for the larger ripple effects that are going to be sweeping our economy, because this is the sort of story that I think we haven't gotten to, that second layer of the impact of the shutdown.
Sure. No, absolutely. And it's one of those things, if the daycares aren't open, people aren't going to be able to return back to offices. It's kind of one thing after another, like you said, a ripple effect.
We're going to have a link to this story over at texasstandard.org. Charles Scudder is a reporter for the Dallas Morning News. Charlie, thanks again for joining us, and I hope you have a peaceful Memorial Day.
Absolutely. You as well. Thanks.
Big 12 college athletes can begin returning to campuses in June. The Lubbock Avalanche Journal reports football players can go back first on June 15th. Volleyball, soccer, and cross-country players can go back as early as July 1st. And the rest can return on July 15th. The decision signals leaders are hoping college sports will continue in some fashion in 2020. The actual details on returns will be left up to individual universities. 39 minutes past the hour.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Tech University's online school program, TTU K-12, offering fully online courses for kindergarten through 12th grade to start anytime from anywhere. Learn more by searching TTU K-12.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. In 1981, Sandra Day O'Connor became the first female justice on the nation's highest court. Her appointment by Republican President Ronald Reagan was a watershed moment for gender equality in the U.S. court system. But Justice O'Connor certainly wasn't the first woman to be considered to occupy a seat on the Supreme Court bench. The overlooked history of 9 women shortlisted for positions on the U.S. Supreme Court of the decades before Judge O'Connor's appointment is rediscovered in an often overlooked history that's contained in a new book co-authored by a University of Houston law professor. It's titled Shortlisted, Women in the Shadows of the Supreme Court. Professor Renee Kanaki Jefferson is Joanne and Larry Doherty Chair in Legal Ethics and professor at the University of Houston School of Law. Professor, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks so much for having me.
You co-wrote this book with Hannah Brenner Johnson of California Western Law School in San Diego. What inspired you two to write about these women who had been shortlisted before O'Connor?
Well, if you think back to when President Obama nominated 2 women to the court, now Justices Kagan and Sotomayor, there was a lot of commentary focused on the gendered aspects of these women's lives, the clothing they would wear, the fact that they were both single, who would accompany them on dates to fancy Supreme Court dinners. And we decided to conduct a media study. We looked at every article written by the New York Times and the Washington Post from the 1970s through their nominations. And we coded them for lots of variables. We found, of course, from that media study, you know, surprise, surprise, not really. The media had a gendered lens. But we also uncovered a really interesting history that included one article written in the New York Times in 1971 about President Nixon's shortlist. There were 2 women on it, a list of 6. One of the women, according to the article, Mildred Lilly, fortunately had no children and even in her 50s maintained her bathing beauty figure. Of course, that fed into our media studies thesis, but we wondered, who's Mildred Lilly? Mm-hmm. Why have we never heard of her before? And how many other women were shortlisted for the U.S. Supreme Court before Sandra Day O'Connor? Was it just Judge Lilly and the other woman who appeared in that article, Sylvia Bacon, or were there more? And that's what led to this book.
I have never heard the names of Bacon or Lilly. That's kind of remarkable. But as you write, it can also be a way for administrations to sort of send a signal about diversity, too, without necessarily having to follow through?
That's exactly right. And just to go back to Nixon, I will tell you, even though he was the first president to put two women out publicly on his shortlist, behind the closed doors of the Oval Office, I've listened to the tapes. And he said things like, I don't think women should even be allowed to vote. But wow, he wanted their vote. So he used that shortlist in the way that we in the book critique shortlists as sometimes being used to give an appearance of caring about diversity and equality, but then ultimately preserving the status quo by who you select when you decide who's coming off it.
In the spirit of the book and trying to shine a light on the stories of some of these women, could you share one or two with us? I mean, did any particular biography strike you as quite remarkable?
Well, I think we have to go back to the first, because the fact that a woman was considered for the U.S. Supreme Court in the 1930s, I think, is just extraordinary. And that woman was Florence Allen. She was considered by FDR. Before she rose to that level of prominence, she was the first woman elected to a state Supreme Court in the country. That was Ohio. She did that by going out and championing for women's suffrage. And once women had the ability to vote, they turned around and elected her to that court. She was the first woman on a federal court of appeals. FDR put her there in 1934. Hmm. When she arrived, there was not even a bathroom for her to use. And her male colleagues, we read accounts in newspaper articles, were so appalled at the idea of having to preside over cases with women that they took to bed ill. In the book, we cover strategies and things that she did then that I think are even relevant still today as we look at positions of leadership and power that don't reflect the diversity of the public we serve.
There have been some substantial changes, though. I noticed that there are more women than men in the nation's law schools these days. What sort of impediments still exist to women rising to the highest tiers of the law?
Well, you're exactly right that women do enter law school in numbers equal to, sometimes greater than men. You would think that we would see that reflected in positions of leadership and power, but we don't. And some of the obstacles that the women in our book faced, I think, are still very relevant today in terms of navigating childcare and being the primary caregiver, both for children and aging parents, but also just stereotypes and assumptions and sometimes implicit bias. You know, we're in a world now where formal, explicit discrimination, you saying, you know, I'm sorry, I can't hire you because we don't have a bathroom here that you can use as a woman, that doesn't exist. But more subtle sorts of discrimination and bias endure. And I think that's part of what, but not, I know that's part of why we don't see women moving into leadership roles in the same numbers that we see them pursuing professional life.
Let me ask a question that I think a lot of listeners may find to be profoundly naive, and yet I think it cuts right to the core of why this would matter. Some people would say that gender really shouldn't matter when you're trying to weigh who's right and who's wrong, what the Constitution actually is, and some of these weighty legal questions, that this is basically a matter of interpreting and deciding, you know, what is the correct course of action. Why does gender matter when it comes to the law?
Well, I think it matters for a couple of reasons. I mean, to your point, a man or a woman could decide cases similarly or differently. And so there are some studies, though, that do show women decide cases differently than men on issues related to domestic violence, sexual harassment, that sort of thing. But it's more than just the particular outcome of a case. It goes to institutional legitimacy for the Supreme Court to reflect the diversity of the public it serves. And related to that, for women to be inspired, and especially female minorities to be inspired to pursue professional roles, we need to see role models. And it's just incredible to me, the women that we profile and shortlisted were often the very first woman. They had no one to look to. I often think back, what would our professional world look like in general had Florence Allen been in that prominent role on the U.S. Supreme Court back in the 1930s? I don't think I'm wrong on this. We would have seen more women in professional life earlier.
Something you just said struck me, and that was this idea of inspiring others. And I wonder what you're ultimately hoping to be the audience for this book. Are you thinking of legal scholars? Are you thinking of potential law students? Who did you have in mind as you were writing?
Well, I think the stories of these women would be interesting to anyone who cares about the history of our country. And we include a lot of juicy tidbits and details, and just the narrative alone, I think, would appeal to anyone. And in terms of the lessons we try to draw from their lives and how they navigated moving into professional life in a world that excluded women, well, those are important lessons for women who are pursuing positions of leadership and power, but also really important lessons for anyone who is in the role of deciding who is chosen, who goes onto a short list, and who comes off. So in that sense, it's a book for everyone.
The name of the book is Shortlisted, Women in the Shadows of the Supreme Court. We've been speaking with its co-author, Renee Kanaki Jefferson. She is University of Houston law professor and the Joanne and Larry Doherty Chair in Legal Ethics there. Professor, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
It's the Texas Standard on this Memorial Day. I'm David Brown. While some newspapers in the northern U.S. have lamented that much of the U.S. border with Canada remains closed due to COVID-19, our border with Mexico has remained partially open. And in a way, that's the border that matters most here on the home front. It's the border we share with Mexico, and it's our connection with people, goods, and services in the South. So what's the state of the pandemic there in neighboring Mexico? For that, we are turning to Eduardo Garcia. He is editor-in-chief of Mexico's financial news agency, InfoCell, and the financial portal Sentido Común, which is common sense, translated. He joins us now from Mexico City. Señor Garcia, welcome to the Texas Standard.
David, thank you. My pleasure to be with you.
I've been following quite a bit of news from the Mexican papers. Tell us a little bit about the situation when it comes to COVID-19. At last check, I understood that people were concerned that the government might be understating the spread in Mexico.
Well, yeah, there are some doubts on the numbers of people who have been catching this new virus, or coronavirus, as well as the number of people who have unfortunately died. And so that has created a certain uncertainty as whether we are being able to flatten the curve or not. But it seems like things have not gotten as well as the government had expected. And the rate of contagious is still growing at a 4 to 6% rate. And it has been steady for the last few days. So there are some doubts of how fast we can open up again. Although the time frame has been set for June 1st, mainly.
On this side of the border, there's been a real concern about testing as a way of gauging what the spread is like and when restrictions can be lifted. What about there in Mexico? Is testing happening, and is it pretty common?
No, that's one of the greatest concerns, I would say, that the government is not testing enough. And to open an economy without the testing is a bit of a risk, I would say.
Some of our listeners may realize that Mexico is Texas's largest trading partner. Now, that border isn't completely shut down, of course, but what sort of impact has this had on the back and forth between the U.S. and Mexico in economic terms?
Well, Mexico did shut down all non-essential activities, like I guess in the States happened too. Now, some of the plants are in Mexico, auto plants and auto part plants, which are crucial for the U.S. economy and maybe even for Texas, will start opening up gradually as they implement some protocols that are needed for workers to be safe. So we'll have to wait and see how that works out, but it might be the beginning of a gradual recovery for those industries that are now being tremendously constrained by the decisions taken by the government.
Let me ask you one other question, if I may, when it comes to the situation on the ground and how people are just getting by. Here in the United States, there have been many people laid off from work, people who can't do their day jobs or can't do their contracting work, drivers for different services and that sort of thing. Here in the States, there have been checks that have been distributed to people. There have been changes to rules on evictions and that sort of thing to try to accommodate the impact on everyday folks' lives. What about in Mexico?
Well, in terms of paychecks, no. The government refused to hand in like the checks that many Americans are now getting. Now, in terms of loans, the banks and the government came up with a joint solution which gave people between 4 and 6 months to stop paying, let's say, their mortgage, their car loans, or their insurance premiums for a period of time. The other day, the Banking Association in Mexico said that 2.7 million people have filed for those benefits that will allow them not to pay for the next 3 to 6 months. So that's one of the elements that is working. The government has cranked up some of its social programs, distributing funds for the elderly, for the young people that are working in certain places that are like apprenticeships. That's a new program that the new government set up. And so that is some relief that is getting to people. But the bulk of this crisis is yet to come. And I think the suffering is yet to be seen. I don't think a lot of businesses will be able to survive. The Restaurant Association, for example, said that 300,000 restaurants have already shut permanently in the whole country. But it's going to be tremendously painful, I would say, for the next 12 to 24 months.
Eduardo Garcia is editor-in-chief of Mexico's financial news agency InfoCell and the financial portal Sentido Común. Thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard, sir.
David, it was a pleasure.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Joining us once again, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Hello there, Wells.
Hello, David. Good to hear from you. We're hearing from, yes, exactly, indeed. And also hearing from folks out there about some of the stories from earlier in the show. One that is soliciting some comments there. How many childcare facilities in Texas are staring down some dire economic issues? Via our Facebook page, Victoria Vlatch writes that Texas didn't prioritize early childhood care or education even before the pandemic. Those who needed it most could least afford it even back then. She goes on to say that high quality childcare and preschool has a significant and meaningful impact on children's lives and by extension on society. We need to prioritize it as an essential social service. So obviously some thoughts there about those issues that those childcare providers are facing here. One of, you know, many businesses across the board, I think you could say. As we mentioned earlier, thoughts are also with the holiday of Memorial Day today out there in on social media from our friends out there. John Huddleston says he is remaining quarantined and calls this the perfect holiday to take measure of the sacrifices a more perfect union requires. That from John Huddleston. Lance Colbert says that he helped put out 50 plus flags with Apollo Duro Kalani's Club of Canyon this morning. He notes that the service put out over 500 flags at the homes and businesses of people out there and helps fund many community service projects from the club. He also says he's flying a flag at his own home to honor the sacrifices so many of us take for granted, and notes, and I should note rather, that many other folks on the Texas Standard Facebook page sharing photos of them flying their flag as well. Of course, it can be kind of hard to keep track of, you know, the holidays and honestly just what day it is with this ongoing, issues here with stay-at-home orders and the like. A very strange sort of holiday to celebrate this go-around. Interesting enough, a tweet here from a fan of the show, Jen Wireman. She notes that this is the first time in 71 days of quarantine I've gotten up early enough to listen to the Texas Standard, and I just want to hear Wells Dunbar say my name on KUT. Oh. So there we go, Jen. There we go. Happy Memorial Day.
You know, something that I'm kind of surprised we haven't heard a whole lot more about, and I guess it has to do with the fact that everyone's at war with COVID-19. But, you know, we have a very important thing coming up on Wednesday. This is of a special interest in here in Texas, which is home of a big part of the space industry. We have SpaceX, which is involved in sending up the first manned mission, which is really a collaboration between SpaceX and NASA. NASA will do the official handover just a couple of hours before liftoff on Wednesday. And boy, it's going to be an exciting event. I bet a lot of people are going to be tuning in online and elsewhere. We'd love to hear from you about that story or anything else that's on your news radar at Texas Standard. Of course, you can always send us an email, texasstandard@kut.org. Out of time for the big broadcast, but we're going to be back here tomorrow. We hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown along with Wells Dunbar and the crew. wishing you a marvelous Memorial Day.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.